Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is a reading of The Iron Monarch. The Iron Monarch, a classic story compiled by Dennis Bainbridge. I like that he didn't author it, he compiled it. So Dennis Bainbridge is the head of the... or president of the Glenbrook and District Historical Society. The story of this great ship from 73 to 2012 by the people who built and served in her and want the story to be recorded. This is this awful thing where you actually read things aloud. I probably have a who in there. I guess I'm going to read the back of this and then we'll read through it. And you poor people overseas, I'll probably have no one left. The Iron Monarch is considered the most loved, iconic ship in the Australian maritime history. This story was compiled by many of the people who designed, built and sailed on her from 73 to 2012. Let's look. That's a fair chunk of time, mate. That's 38 years. Designed as an efficient mode of steel products transport by the BHP transport team under the guidance of Robert McClellan, a forward thinker who realised that the old methods of shipping steel products were obsolete, a new concept was required. The concept was accepted by the BHP board and two ships were ordered to be built in the Whyalla Shipyard and Engineering Works. The ships were to be called the Iron Monarch and the Iron Duke. The decision to use heavy gas-duty gas turbine propulsion using low-cost Bass Strait residual fuel oil resulted in her being the first such powered vessel in the world, and this created much worldwide interest. He's a good rider, isn't he, this Dennis? The ships were withdrawn from service in 83 due to a downturn in the steel business, large increases in the cost of the fuel and engine regenerator problems. That could have been the end of the story, however. A requirement arose to carry 30-ton steel slabs from BHP Port Kembla to Western Port Works, so the Iron Monarch was selected to be converted to a slab carrier. She was re-engined with diesel power and her cranes retrofitted with magnets. She commenced this service in 86 until her withdrawal in October 2011 due to the closure of the Western Port Hot Strip Steel Mill. During her life, she carried over 24 million tons of cargo, surely a record of any Australian vessel. BlueScope Steel quickly sold her for scrap value, and she ended her days being demolished on a beach in Alang, India. This is a story that will never be repeated in Australian maritime history. Well, there you go. That's really got me interested. It's compiled by Dennis Bainbridge. Let's get in. Forward. In this 21st century of cruise ships and massive container ships, one may ask why all the fuss over an Australian unitised steel-carrying vessel. It is true that during the late 60s and early 70s, world shipping was undergoing big changes. Conventional freighters and reefers were giving way to container ships. BHP was not alone in seeking new transport methods, as explained in this history. However, the complete shift to steelworks packaged containers of ship products in 30-ton half containers rolled into and out of specialised roll-on, roll-off ships via shipboard ramp onto strengthened land-backed wharves and thence onward to the customer was a brave act of faith, a tremendous outlay of money and resources for an untried approach. The new concept would involve retaining of everyone along the supply chain, retraining. Dependent on hydraulics, electronics and shipboard cranes running the length of the vehicle deck. This before the personal computer had arrived. Electronics that today would be housed in a shoebox required a compartment to fill the width of the engine room. To a certain extent, seamen had lived with electronics, radar, autopilots, echo sounders, and had long been part of the equipment. It was expected they would learn to handle this new automation. Waterside waters had become more mechanised during recent years, but 30-ton straddle trucks and internal gantry cranes would present a vastly new challenges. This is mainly a story of a ship and those of us who sailed in her. The people ashore who provided the knowledge, support, essential operating services were wonderfully loyal and performed great feats to keep the row ships in service. We acknowledge their contribution, but the spaces does not allow full detail of the dedication to ships. Thanks for your enthusiasm. A brief word about manning. By today's standards, the 73 Iron Monarch was heavily overmanned. Officers aboard the ships of the fleet thought we were enjoying an easy ride. Those of us who endured the early years would disagree. The demands of training, water sizes to operate the equipment, and working without the advantages which came later when various frustrating operational problems were rectified ashore and shipboard. The original crew did have the advantage of meeting suppliers and technical people when the ship was building. These representatives were willing to teach us operational and maintenance requirements that allowed us to test run their product as it was being installed. This was a great leg up. Oh, gee, Dennis is a fantastic writer. Congratulations, that was the forward. Alright, let's go on. Oh, this is not by Dennis, it's Peter Lamarck, January 2012. The most essential requirement of the RORO is local knowledge. Spell this for you, RO-RO. Problems and solutions being freely recorded and passed on those who follow. The company recognised this and allowed observer trips for new personnel joining the trade. In some instances, senior engineers ended up with more practical knowledge of the gas turbines than the General Electric people. The Iron Monarch's record will be hard to top, steaming almost 2 million miles and carrying 24 million tonnes of cargoes over a 38-year lifespan. Probably no other Australian ship or indeed 50,000-tonne deadweight vessel anywhere has lasted longer or carried such tonnage. It was the world's first of a unitised steel carrier. When the Iron Monarch was given its second life as a diesel-propelled slab carrier, Captain Jeff Herbert, who had already had become a year's service in the RORO vessel, was seconded as a commissioning master. Possibly he spent longer in the ship than any of us. His memories and advice have been great value in compiling the history of the vessel. To all those unmanned people, both afloat and ashore, who gave their knowledge and effort and loyalty to keep this remarkable old ship trading, I wish you well, and know ours is a shared pride at having been part of the venture. Peter Lamarck, January 2012. Introduction. 39 years ago, I was involved in the first heavy-duty gas turbine for the BHP company in the GTV Iron Monarch, which is the first of 8 gas turbine powered ships built in Whyalla Shipbuilding Engineering Company, Whyalla, South Australia. I worked for the Australian General Electric AGE and the local office for the General Electric Company USA GE, who designed all the gas turbines and used these ships and built turbines and used BHP ships. I commenced working for the AGE in 1963 as a computer technician, which was rare for a person who initially trained as the fitter and term. I installed the first banking computer system in Australia for the banks of New South Wales, now Westpac. In 1986, I transferred to the industrial system business, installing steel mill process control computers. This led to taking over the servers of the central operating system used on 4 steam bulk carriers built in Whyalla, which flowed on to my involvement in the gas turbine ships. When the AGE closed down in 1985, most of the records of these ships were archived and lost forever as part of some of the files which I had retained and stored in my garage. I recently found these files and thought the story should be recorded are there is nothing available as there is nothing available published on the internet for future reference. In late 2008, I started to contact ex-BHP officers who had sailed these ships to try and piece together the facts together to knowing the written records that were not available. Captain Peter Lamarck lived nearby, so I rang him and explained the idea of building up a story on these ships, and he agreed to help. I also approached Ken Farrell and others in Newcastle who agreed to assist the story and passing of Vince Calais and Reg Jones meant their stories were lost forever. I will cover my experience to the best of my memory and pass it around to others to add their memories. And there will be a section on operations, which is Peter and Jeff's records are probably the best recorded section. His story of the Iron Mark is such an interesting story of the rebirth to its life of diesel-powered slab carrier is unique in the history of Australian shipping. After her 2011 docking, it was expected that she would continue service to at least 2016. However, the owner, Bluehost Steel, had suddenly exited the export steel business, which means the Iron Mark was laid up at Port Kembla in December 2011. The decision on a future as a coil carrier was eagerly awaited. However, the axe fell when Bluehost Steel on January 25th, 2012 announced that the coil transport contract was awarded to Pacific National Rail. With the announcement, the future of the Iron Mark was unknown as she was to be sold. Oh, he goes on. During the period of the authors received great assistance from the TK Marine personnel in allowing Peter Lamarck and myself to visit the ship for the last time before she sailed to Singapore. My thanks go to Robert Grumman at CA Lovett and her last master, David Kemp. Finally, by a stroke of good luck, we were able to join the Wilson family on the Schuster Line boat to follow her out of Port Kembla Harbour on the very dark, wet night. This I Will Never Forget by Dennis Bainbridge. Acknowledgements. My God, this will go for a while. In 2008, I decided to clean out my garage, which contained many files from my employment at the Australian General Limited, where I was employed as a service manager for the gas turbines and other products. The Iron Mark material started my thoughts about my involvement in the gas turbine vessel. The Iron Mark was always my favourite and the first of the eight built at the Whaler shipyard. Although I lost my contract with the ship after her first removal from service in 1983, she was always in the back of my mind. I contacted Peter Lamarck, ship's first master, who lived near me and managed a meeting, and that was the birth of this project. Peter had saved records, which he gave us a start in assembling the facts and compiled the story. As the story started to evolve, the more interesting it became. Peter had written the basic program, which tracked the loading bolsters onto the ship. Without Peter, this story would have been as interesting as wouldn't have been as interesting, as he provided the material of the operation chapters, the stability issue amongst others. Next, we contacted Jeff Herbert, who was the master after the slab conversion and was able to provide extensive material on various aspects of the village vessel's slab carrier operations. Derek Slim, who was involved in the cargo handling at Port Kembla, Derek outlined how the cargo was sorted and loaded for maximum effect. Cargo scheduling was very important for effective working of the vessel. Even Stephens was always ready to assist in the sourcing of information and photographs. In my time working on the vessel, I worked with Ken Farrell and the chief engineer over the gas turbine period. Ken provided important information on the ship's concept, design and later operation. I knew Ken from the SS Iron Hunter days and was always had a good working relationship. We were guessing who was involved in the initial design of the concept of the ship design. A BHP reunion lunch in 2009, Peter introduced me to Dick Grono, who was involved in the process, and he finally led to the concept design. Next, we checked down Bob McKellen, who was the BHP manager shipping, and was a driving force with the project. When he asked Bob to record his memories, we agreed his story of the concept development, illustrated, and the final concept was a result of research and experience. We learnt that Bob had built a model ship to help the BHP board understand the concept. During my employment with the Australian General Electric Limited, I had extensive contacts with GE Gas Turbine Department. Bill Rowan was the driving force of this project. Bill had written many papers for GE and ASME, which were a great help in assembling the story. Another gas turbine employee I had a lot of time for was Don Rexford, who was a control engineer. Don was gentle. Here we go. Beautiful paper this book's written, isn't it? Soul, and he taught me a lot about speed trotted control. Sadly, he passed away. The Valiant straddle trucks serve a special mention as they are a vital element in the project. It has been estimated that they carry up to 3 times the total cargo carried by the ship. My thanks to Trevor Murdoch for his input to the story. We received assistant material from TK personnel, including Captain Jim Dench, who provided photographs and some experiences on the vessel. Captain Cameron Crumpton, who provided information and photographs. Robert Graham, Sean Quentin, and the Chief Engineer, Alan Lovett, were always available to assist us to visit the ship. Captain David Kemp, her Australian master, her last Australian master, was great assistance. Many photographs were received, and we've tried to acknowledge the authors. And we know a future project would be the collation of photographs from all sources to create a permanent record of the amazing vessel's life. There are sure to be many others who have missed in assembling the story. Okay, we're up to 16 minutes. I'll try for half an hour. Chapter 1, GE and the gas turbines. Frank Whittle and his company Power Jets had developed the gas turbine engine, the W1, as part of the World War II interchange of information with the US and the Tizard mission. And the Tizard mission at W1 was sent to the USA in 1942. As GE was very successful with aircraft turbochargers production, they were given the job of building the first USA gas turbine engine, which GE called the I-16-1A. The USAF later changed it to the J-13 Figure 1. The engine produced 1,650 pounds of thrust, weighing in at 850 pounds. The total of 241 engines were built. GL scaled the engine up to produce the I-40 with 4,000 pounds thrust. USAAF, US Air Force, called the J-33 and gave it to Allison, which was upset. The GE Lynn MA plant still produces defence and commercial engines. At the end of the war, a team working on the axial flow turbines were redirected to design turbines for industrial power generations. So this is basically, it's got a big fan and a big heat jet. So you put in gas and you get power out. Heavy duty gas turbines, unlike the aero engines, is a large, heavily framed machine running at lower speeds. They have much lower compression bypass ratio and are less efficient. Designed to be a workhorse, which can be maintained on site and can use very heavy grade fuels. They come in single or two shaft versions. These units were built at a large GE gas turbine facility in Shastadi, New York. A number of other companies are licensed to build the same model turbines. So basically, you need a gas turbine to get something out in the air. They've got a lower quality fuel, for junk fuel going. The first power generation system was in 49, was a model MS-3001 single-shaft gas turbine rated at 3,500 kilowatts supplied on the Oklahoma Gas and Electric Company Belle Island Power Station. Its exhaust was used to preheat the boiler feed for a 52,000 kilowatt steam station. So that's a big steam station. Union Pacific UP had tried steam turbine power for its locomotives in the 1930s, which was unsuccessful. They were looking for powerful engines, which is why they moved to gas turbines, steam. Oh, okay. So rather than using steam, you use gas. The first locomotive, GE-101, was built in 1948. by the Alco GE F49 was tested by UP to prove the concept. The locomotive was renumbered the UP number 50, although it was never owned by UP. The turbine produced 4,800 horsepower, which is twice the power available from diesel units. A small diesel unit was used for uncoupled shunting for starting the turbine. After the turbine was spun up to starting speed and fired with distillate fuel, after reaching operating speed, the fuel was switched to Bunker C fuel oil that had been heated to 200 degrees Fahrenheit to allow it to flow easily. The fuel was carried in a tender. My God, you're getting all these details. From 1952, 100 units were delivered over numbers 51 to 60. 1954, 15 more units, 61 to 75, were ordered. Between 58 and 61, 30 units of 800 and 500 horsepower entered the service, the largest locomotives ever built. So that's pretty interesting in terms of that. You know, you've got these different fuel. A diesel starts spinning, then you put in one fuel. It's just when did you heat it up? So you need lower and lower grade fuel going in. Okay, so you just, you know, good fuel, it's pretty interesting. Further development resulted in a two-shaft machine for compressor drives for gas pipes. Marine propulsion. We'll now look back at the history of the gas turbines and marine power applications. In 1951, the UK tanker Oris was retrofitted with a British Thomson Hudson 1200 SHP gas turbine working in conjunction with three diesel operating for 20,000 hours. In 1956, the plant was changed to one 5,500 SHP gas turbine operating for 5,000 hours, whatever that means. The US Department of Commerce, Maritime Administration, MRAD, was looking at different power plants to retrofit World War II Liberty ships. My God. The Liberty ships were just pumped out. Now, this is, you can imagine, these ships were put together, and so these are the ships that people were knocking them down, so they just could pump these ships out. But they have pretty crap engines, I would imagine. It wouldn't matter how fast they go, as long as they get out there, it's sunk, it'll be okay. Okay. One of four schemes was for heavy. Of four schemes was heavy-duty gas turbines, so GE was selected to provide the equipment. The SS John Sargent, a Liberty ship built in 1942 at the Baltimore Fairfield Shipyard Incorporated, was extended and retrofitted in 1956. My God, that's around for a long time after World War II. By the Newport Shipbuilding Company with GE 6600 SHP gas turbine, reduction gear, available pitch propeller. The main fuel was Bunker C, which burnt for 7,000 hours in a total operational lifetime of 9,700 hours. She was laid up in the James Rivers and in 1972 scrapped in Portsmouth, PA. The result of the successful test was further development of. You can imagine the amount of Liberty junk ships out on the sea. It's amazing. The result of this successful test was further development contract, which issued in 1970 to refine the maritime heavy-duty gas turbine system based on a second generation of MS-3002. The following areas of investigation were corrosion and deposit removal, turbine clean, fuel treatment improvement, development of reversing gas turbine, regenerator improvement, eliminate fuel washing. Wow. After these studies, the upgrade of the turbine design in all areas, which resulted in increased power from 91,000 to, I suppose it would be, I don't quite understand that one, 11,0 HP over a period of 66 to 69. In 1968, GE commenced the design of a large two-shaft machine in the ranges of 20,000 and 27,000 horsepower. The compressor design was similar to the MS-5001 package generator units, and the turbine selection was scaled up from the MS 3002, the Model M Mary had fixed inlet glide valves and 15-stage compressor. The N model Nancy had a variable inlet guard vanes and 16-stage compressor units with the MS 5002 series. It goes on. Gas turbine operation. Gas turbine is a machine using the Baton cycle, figure 3. The simple cycle, single shaft unit. Air is taken into the inlet guard vanes, passing through the compressor, where it's pressurized to increase by a factor of 8 to 120 psa. Okay. The temperature due to compression is 540 degrees Fahrenheit. The compressor output is pressed into the combustion system, where it's mixed with the fuel, ignited, and the resultant gas flow at a constant pressure with the temperature of 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit is passed through the first stage nozzle, and then the turbine stages provide power and drive for both the compressor and the lobe. So it's basically a jet engine sitting itself. To increase the efficiency, we can preheat the compressor outlet airflow before it goes into combustion. See you. This is achieved by using a heat exchanger called the regenerator, where the exhaust air imparts a percentage of its heat to the combustion air. This can improve the efficiency by 20 to 30%. In a simple cycle machine, to achieve firing temperatures of 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit would require a certain amount of fuel. By using the regenerator, the compressor air is heated by exchange with the exhaust gas to 850 degrees Fahrenheit, which means less fuel to achieve the firing temperature of 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit, a saving of 27%. As the gas turbine is a mass air movement device, its power and efficiency will vary with the ambient temperature. The rated power is specified at a fixed temperature. For the RoRo ships, it was 80 degrees Fahrenheit. As the temperature decreases, the air becomes more dense, which increases the airflow through the turbine. This will increase the output of the horsepower and decrease the desired heat rate. The regenerators are a very important device in the total system and will play an important part of this story. Turbine construction. For the marine propulsion, a two-shaft machine is used, as shown in figure 5. This consists of a high-pressure rotor, HP, and a low-pressure or load rotor. The HP rotor consists of a compressor wheels and first-stage turbine rotor. The LP rotor consists of second-stage turbine wheel and load coupling device, drive phase. Between the HP rotor and the LP rotor is a set of variable second-stage nozzles which can load share between the two turbines. The nozzle ring rotating and moving levers which turn the second-stage nozzles move the nozzles. HP turbine drives the compressor. The LP turbine drives the load to the requested power level. A second-stage nozzle controls the speed of the HP rotor to control the amount of airflow and exhaust temperature. As the exhaust temperature raises, the nozzles open and increase the airflow and lower the exhaust temperature. The HP rotor reaches full speed. The control restricts the fuel to hold the required exhaust temperature. At this point, the machine is fully loaded. Oh, that's pretty amazing. I think I sort of understand that. My God. The combustion chassis consists of 12 combustion liners which fit in combustion wrappers that surrounds the compressor discharge casing. Each liner is connected by a crossfire tube which allows the flame to circulate when the spark plug ignites the liner. There are two spark plugs and two flame detectors supplied to allow backup if one fails. Fuel is injected into the liner by a fuel nozzle with atomized air where it is burnt where a highly turbulent. The reaction occurs at temperatures above 1,650 degrees Celsius. Now we're going to Celsius now. The combustion liners are designed to stabilise the flame at high velocity stream over a wide range of fuel types and flows. In figure 0.6, preheated compressor discharge air from the regenerator or simple cycle direct from the compressor flows in reverse along the outside surface of the combustion line to provide air from the combustion in the reaction zone. The next nozzle is a cooling zone followed by a dilution zone where the compressor discharge air flows through the combustion line louvre slots to mix with the high temperature combustion air. Compressor discharge air is also provided cooling with external transition piece surface. The two flange pipe outlets are the connection points of the regeneration air piping. The aft flange is for the compressor discharge air to be preheated in the regenerator to be returned to combustion liners via the forward flange. Well, there you go. The output of each liner connects to the transition piece and directs the hot gas to the first stage nozzle evenly around the circumference of the pass through the first stage nozzle to drive the HP turbine. I'm just coughing, I don't have coronavirus, I hope. The first stage nozzle suffers the most severe duty of all components of the turbine. Gas flow passes the second stage nozzle to be directed to the LP turbine, provide the power to provide the load. The turbine can be dismantled to half shell by removing the top half of each casing, thus exposing the internal rotor and bearings. The components of each bearing's first stage nozzles can be rolled out and replaced. The HP and LP wheel buckets are easy to replace as each bucket is moment weighted and computer program works out in what sequence they are installed for perfect balance. The buckets and cover plates are held in the wheel dovetails on fir trees by twist locks. When cold, buckets rattle easily. Okay. Turbine operation. The turbine can be started if all permissives are met. The auxiliary lube oil and hydraulic oil pumps are started to establish required pressure. The starting clutch is engaged and the electric motor starting motor starts to rotate the HP shaft through the torque converter and reduction gear. So, torque converter, I've done a thing about that. So this is how you just increase the torque. It's a hydraulic flow coupling. When the HP rotor reaches 20% speed at 14 HM, the unit is purged for 2 minutes, starting the fuel flows to the fuel nozzles. The spark plugs are energized for 60 seconds until flame is detected by the flame detectors when the fuel is reduced to warm-up level to reduce the thermal stress of the machine and internal components. At the finish of the warm-up, the start control then increases the fuel at a controlled rate to accelerate the machine to operating speed. As the HP, my God, it keeps on going, HP shaft speed increases to 60%. It reaches a point where speed exceeds the starter motor and throws the clutch out of engagement, which turns off the starter motor. The HP speed takes over and moves to the second stage nozzle and holds HP speed for 80% 14 HS. At this point, the electric pumps are turned off and the complete sequence is notified and the machine is ready to load. The HP shaft breaks away at 50% horsepower shaft speed. The HP shaft load determines the amount of fuel required by the turbines. The load is determined by the bridge propulsion lever position. A marine feature was a hot restart where the turbine didn't have to come to a complete stop before a new cycle could be initiated. A friction clutch was engaged at 10% speed to synchronize the shaft and starter motor clutch jaws before which clutch engaged the starting rotor power was applied to commence the new cycle. When the turbine was stopped, the HP shaft needed to be rotated for 12 hours to prevent the HP shaft bowing. This controlled by a ratchet system. My God, when the turbine stopped, the shaft had to keep on going for some reason. I don't quite understand. Turbine cleaning. turbine cleaning system was required for machines burning heavy fuels. There were two cleaning methods. A, water washing, to remove sodium and any other dirty oil deposits from the compressor blades. The machine, while the crank was while on the crank, will have water and detergent solution sprayed onto the compressor inlet, where it will swirl around the blades, cleaning off any deposits. Some systems will also clean the combustion cans. Abrasive cleaning. When burning residual fuel ash deposits and build up on the first stage nozzle, which can reduce efficiency. Crushed nutshells are fed into the pressurized hopper before cleaning control system injects them into the compressor and combustion cans are dislodged at any deposits. So what type of shells are they? Crushed nutshells. The distillate fuel ships don't have this cleaning skid arrangement, and only simple water spray jets. You can imagine a nuclear power station is quite good, I come to think of it. If some abrasive cleaning is required, rice and nut shells is thrown onto the inlet through the simple pipe to the inlet air duct during operation. It can be sent. It can be seen that the gas turbine is a simple machine with a few moving parts. However, it requires a high level of design engineering and materials due to the thermal stresses it encounters and the effects of poor quality fuels. The fired hours to start ratio is important, as a low ratio results in more thermal stretches to hot gas path components, the regenerator. Can you imagine this entire thing? This is all basically, I've built my jet fighters, now I want to burn shit. So we're bad fuels. The TR regenerator, as described, to improve the efficiency of the regenerator system was used to preheat the combustion air by passing it through the heat exchanger with the exhaust gas. The regenerators were supplied by Harrison Radiator Company and Davison General Motors, a division of General Motors. These units were subject to severe thermal cycling as 1 minute they were cold, and as soon as the turbine starts, the exhaust gas phase is subjected to 9,500 degrees, while the exhaust gas phase lost 360 degrees Fahrenheit to the combustion air, which adds an overall thermal stress on the assembly. The first regenerator used on BHP railroad ships were the Harrison TR bar plate design, so we know there's going to be a second one. The compressor airflow is in the reverse discharge. Air is piped the inlet manifold, which distributes the air in all channels to be heated by the exhaust flows. Can you imagine now these ships would be completely computer controlled? Nice thick pages, or can go on, fairly interesting design. The plate bar construction is shown in figure 8. The exhaust gas tube consists of copper braze welded envelope. An internal corrugated heat transfer surface called the gas center. The center allows for the maximum heat transfer and provides strength to resist the pressure compression air passing through the air channel. Each turbine is 100 inches long and 28 inches wide and 1 inch high. None of these tubes separated by a spacer welded together to make up a bank. Pressurized and strong bank regenerator. The problem with the TR plate and bar construction is that straps interconnecting massive end frames band the regenerator banks together. The high-pressure compressor will try to push apart the tube banks and tend to warp and bow the end frame structure. In the TR, this was prevented by using thick structural ribs incorporated in massive end frames. This creates a thermal mismatch problem between the tube banks and the end structures. As the tube banks expand more quickly than the end banks, causing undesirable stretching of the regenerator. In 1973, General Motors received a patent for a new design called the pressurized strong back regenerator. To try to relieve the problem by replacing the heavy structural ribs with a pressurized air chamber, this unit can be identified by the dome strong backs. The last six Australian gas turbine ships used the interim model generator. As time proved, it offered little to achieving the increased regenerator life. As part of the contract with the United States Marine Administration, GE, in February 1975, patented a new design generator, the pressurized tube, which would be ready in 76 delivery, too late for the Australian ships. The design results in vast improvement in the number of starts before cracking. The goal was 1,000 cold starts, which was exceeded by 250% on the test rig. The rate reduction goal was 30%, as there wasn't any need for strong backs. Pictures here, you've got your generators, heaters, turbine control systems. My God, how far does it go for? Well, I'm going to stop at page 13 and send this off to Dennis. Hope you like it. On the trampoline. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.